Hello and welcome to episode 12 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. This one's a particular favorite of both Nick and I, Hit the Ice. I'm Jerry Shario, and the guy who's here with me, he's an irrepressible force that needs to be forcibly repressed, Nick Santamaria.
Now you got me all repressed. You know, sometimes when I don't do a good job on my pants, I have to repress them.
Yeah.
But that's here nor there, Jerry. Thank you for that lovely and rather perfunctory introduction.
Well, I wanted to get to the good stuff quickly, you know.
Yeah, I'm glad. Oh, you young kids today. You got to have everything right now. You got to have it now. You sit in front of the microwave going, come on, come on, come on. Anyway, so we are here, and it's, as always, a pleasure to see you, Jerry.
And you as well.
Thank you very much, and it's good to be seen. And how are you doing? Get the preliminaries out of the way. How you been?
Doing well, doing well. Listeners may recall I was a little under the weather last episode. That's all under the bridge, as they say, and I want to leave it there.
From under the weather to under the bridge.
Yes.
But I was going to bring something else up. You're doing something rather special tomorrow. Aren't you?
Yes, yes. My family has been involved with this fundraising walk for type 1 diabetes research, an organization that was until recently called the JDRF, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. They are now Breakthrough T1D for type 1 diabetes. And so, yeah, my son, he was diagnosed at age 4 with type 1 diabetes. And so this has been a project our family's been involved with for quite a few years now.
I think that's an incredible thing. I really do. And I love the fact that your son is in there pitching too and helping other people out, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And he's captain of our walk team, and he brings his ventriloquist dummy to the walk every year and entertains the younger kids as we're all waiting to start. Yeah.
Oh, my. If I had to walk like tomorrow morning, I'd want to walk with somebody who has a ventriloquist dummy. I mean, that's just me, but seriously, yep. It would be so much more interesting than not having someone there with a ventriloquist dummy. I'm all for it. And I wish you all the luck in the world tomorrow.
Thank you.
That's a wonderful thing you're doing. So yeah, and we're here, and this is fantastic. We've been getting some very nice response on our podcast. The last one we're already up to on just on YouTube alone. We're inching towards 400 listens. Mm. Also, I'm looking at like Rio Rita. I didn't expect that one to get so many listens, but boy, oh boy, it's up there.
Nice.
So, yeah. So I've been trying to keep track. I'm not exactly sure how to keep this growing, doing all the promotional stuff that needs to be done. But I'm just enjoying the hell out of this. And people have been really writing some wonderful things. They're enjoying the show. So that makes me very happy. So we are looking at a film that Jerry mentioned earlier. It is a special favorite of the two of us.
Yeah.
I told Jerry before we went on the air that this movie, it's not one you think of right away. You know, when you think of Abbott and Costello movies, Hit the Ice. But it's one of the best. It's one of their best films, especially from this period. And I was telling Jerry that as much as I love whodunit, this is just a hair behind whodunit. It's that good. Mm-hmm. And the music is back. So if you're not a music fan, that's going to be a negative for you. But for me, they made up for the songs in It Ain't Hay, Harry Revel and Paul Webster, and really wrote some really nice songs. There are some beautiful ballads and some great upbeats. Johnny Long and his orchestra are featured in the film, and they even do a number that's reminiscent of their big hit, which was an old shanty town where the orchestra would sing in rhythm. All the guys would stand up and sing in rhythm, and it's a great recording. And they do a really nice thing at the end, the finale of this film.
I want to say that when I saw in the opening credits who wrote the songs for Hit the Ice, my brain went back to It Ain't Hay, and I thought, oh no. But it's like night and day, really, the difference between the songs in these two films.
Yeah, yeah. It's like they saved the good ones for this one. They knew they had Jenny Sims, so you know they were going to play up to her.
Okay,
there's so much to talk about. So here's where we're at this point. They finish shooting It Ain't Hay, and Lou and Anne give birth to young Lou Jr., who Lou dubs as Butch. Bud and his Betty adopted Bud Jr. towards the end of the summer when they got back from their tour. So they went on their tour, 34 cities. They made $85 million, one night stands, and it was a killer schedule. Mm-hmm. Then they get off the train and they go right into It Ain't Hay. They give birth to Butch, little Lou Jr. And 2 weeks later, they're back before the camera. Universal puts them back mm-hmm. in front of the camera. Now, they haven't had a chance to breathe at this point. but you would never know it watching this film. This is one of the reasons I love this film so much. They still have that energy, that young, goofy, ad-libby, you know, energy.
Oh, yeah.
You think about it. After all of that stuff that they went through to get there, and then to have to throw them right back into another film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, you know, they're all over the place. It's a very energetic film. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm bringing this all up is it does not have a happy ending. As we get to the end of this episode, I will warn you, a spoiler alert, it takes us to a place where the boys they're forced to rest. They're forced to take a break. Mm-hmm. And they should have paced themselves better, but they didn't. I guess, I don't know, Jerry, how you would feel about it. Being a performer, people are handing you all these opportunities. They're handing you all this stuff. And I don't think I would think about, oh, I can't do this. I can't do that. I want to do everything, you know, especially yes. when you're struggling. So, yeah, it must be difficult.
Yeah, I would imagine, especially at that level. You know, I can only speak from personal experience. There was about a space of 2 years where I was attempting to make my full-time job on stage uh-huh. and managed to get quite a few jobs through the course of three different theaters, mm-hmm. One of which was in Florida, and here I am in Washington State. And so, yeah.
was there a petition?
Just the opposite. After 2 years of working at that theater, my family said, no more. Because I'd be gone for 2, 3, 5 months at a time. But yeah, but it does take its toll. And you feel like I've got to say yes to everything because there may not be another.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, I have to understand in a way that they are grabbing what they can. The trouble is, I think Lou always had health problems. You know, he didn't always mm-hmm. acknowledge them, and he didn't really take care of himself very well. And just thinking about that schedule, there is a very brief story I want to tell about their tour mm-hmm. before they started It Ain't Hay. There was a 13-year-old kid or an 11-year-old kid who made his way to, I think it was in Iowa. It might have been Des Moines. They were stopping to do one of their things. And the kid sneaked into their hotel and approached them and said, I'm putting on a show in my backyard. It's about an hour away from here. I can give you 75 cents if you come and da da da. They showed up with a caravan and they showed up at this kid's house. You couldn't get near the house. The place was like inundated with people. And they did a show for this kid's raising for the war effort. How about that?
Wow.
Lou, at one point, Lou was auctioning off his shirt and somebody offered something and then he topped it by $2 so he didn't have to take it off. So the boys are, you know, they're in there pitching, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so they do It Ain't Hay, and Lou and Ann have a new addition to the house. So they go back to what they're best at, being Abbott and Costello, not being Damon Runyon characters, but being Abbott and Costello. Mm-hmm. And this movie, it's a milestone, a first-time director. This is Charles Lamont. He makes me laugh because Charles Lamont came from Max Sennett, the Max Sennett Studios. You know, so he was an expert at slapstick, writing gags, directing them. And he also worked for the Christie Studios in the silent days of slapstick. As he got into the talkies, he worked with Buster Keaton at educational films when Buster was, you know, on his heels. It really was the last kind of decent work that he did. And he did that with Charlie Lamont. So Charlie Lamont was at Universal, and he was directing mostly, you know, some Westerns, but mostly situation comedies, human comedies, things he liked doing. And he, when he found out they wanted him to do an Abbott and Costello movie, he didn't want to do it. He did not want to be pegged as an Abbott and Costello director. Now, I could understand that, too. He's working towards becoming a director of solid stories, you know, rather than the thing where they stop and do a routine and then a song and then this and that. But the interesting thing is he ended up making 8 movies with the boys.
Can and you imagine how many he would have made if he wanted to be an Abbott and Costello director?
He actually got along great with them, and he did some good movies with them. He did Invisible Man was one of their better ones. The Mummy their last for Universal. Excellent stuff. He did a few clinkers too, but he was good. They at this point, they started splitting up the work between mostly between Charlie Lamont, Gene Yarborough, and Charles Barton, who happens to be my favorite. So anyway, so you got your first time director, Charlie Lamont, and he was also given credit for discovering Shirley Temple, which I found interesting. Yeah, yeah, no, it's true. He was actually looking for the Mount Sinai Temple in Beverly Hills, but he went to the wrong address, and he ended up at Shirley's house.
There you go.
It was a dead giveaway. She didn't have a yarmulke on, and you know. So anyway, I have 2 corrections from last week. I kept saying, not only last week, but the week before, that this was the last movie produced by Alex Gottlieb. Well, no, I was wrong. This is the last movie produced by Alex Gottlieb. And he came back to do Jack and the Beanstalk and Meet Captain Kidd 10 years later. Okay, so I wanted to clear that up. And my buddy Paul Castiglia, a friend to the podcast, you remember Paulie? He corrected me also. I said that it was Matt Willis who played the werewolf in the Three Stooges short Idle Rumors, when in fact it was Duke York. My mistake. I'm really sorry. I really am. But I was never good at the royals. You know, that whole family thing. It's just, it confuses me.
Yeah.
Especially members of the royal family that turn into werewolves. And bother the Three Stooges. Okay. And we have Alex Gottlieb's last, Charlie Lamont's first, and the boys are Flash and Tubby. I love those names.
Yes.
Flash, because they're photographers. That's Bud. And Tubby, because he's Tubby. You know, it's a sort of onomatopoetica.
Yes.
So now let's talk about this movie. This movie is a, you know, when we talked about Pardon My Sarong was sort of a satire on the jungle movies that Paramount was making. Yeah. Well, mostly, I'm going to say mostly 20th Century Fox. In 1936, Sonja Henie was part of the Olympics, the big famous Germany Olympics with Hitler and everything. And gold medal winner. She was just, you know, fantastic. 20th Century Fox, Daryl Zanuck signed her to a contract. And before Esther Williams, another sports figure that became a movie star, she became the first real athlete to become a star, a real star, Sonja Henie. And she was an incredible ice skater. She couldn't act her way out of a wax paper ball. Have you gone there to the wax paper ball? It's terrific.
I missed it last year. Yeah.
Yeah. I met my 7th wife there, which was good reason for not going back. but anyway, so we have that going for us. What was I saying? I forget what I was talking
Sonja
about.
Sonja Henie. 20th Century Fox, yes.
Yeah, signed her to a long-term contract. Her first movie was called One in a Million, which was the second movie of the Ritz brothers, the fabulous Ritz brothers. And Sonja Henie continued making movies into the mid to late 1940s. And she was very, very popular. Her movies made money, and she had dimples and stuff. You know, she was cute. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, couldn't act. You know, oh, I want to go on the ice. But, you know, luckily they had people like Jack Oakey and Milton Berle or Joan Davis, you know, really, really entertaining people, the Ritz brothers. And then she always had good leading men, Tyrone Power, Cesar Romero, Debbie Reynolds, all of them. So this movie was really a comment on those movies. Right. There were movies without Sonia also that took place in Sun Valley. Sun Valley, Idaho was the ski resort of the stars during those years. And that's where this movie supposedly takes place. And it is one of those movies. It is, again, it was Universal's got their hand in on these skiing, ice skating movies. That's Hit the Ice. And it's late November. It's November 26th. It's right around Thanksgiving when they start shooting in 1942. And the movie opens at a hospital, at the Fulton Hospital. And working at a hospital is Dr. Patrick Knowles, who is back after Whodunit.
Yep.
He really enjoyed working with the boys. And I think it's even more obvious in this movie.
Yes.
He's part of it. He fits right in. And there are scenes in this movie between him and Bud, especially, that I noticed that, you know what I mean? When it's very rare to see scenes with Bud without Lou, you know, even when they're talking to someone else. But he kind of forms a bond with Patrick Knowles in this movie. So Patrick Knowles is a doctor, and Elise Knox is our pretty nurse. And she was the daughter of the then Secretary of War under Roosevelt at the time. And she ended up marrying football star Tom Harmon. And they ended up having a son called Mark Harmon, who's on that NCIS thing that I've never seen.
Yeah.
But I hear it's good.
He made one or two of those episodes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Over 13 years or something. Yes.
Well, that's mom. Mom is the nurse, our intrepid nurse. And here's what's going on in the hospital. In one room is Silky Fellowsby. Yes. What a name. And that's Sheldon Leonard. Now, Sheldon Leonard, he's a bank robber. He's a mobster. And he's got two henchmen that hang out with him. And that's Joe Sawyer and Mark Lawrence. So you've got three of the best gangsters in Hollywood history as your villains. And this is why I wasn't crazy about it. Ain't hey, you didn't have this, you know? You had three guys like the Frankenstein monster, the Wolfman, and Dracula. You've got these three great mobsters, you know? That's one of the reasons I love this film so much.
I just now made the connection. You were talking about Whodunit. And here we've got
Mark Lawrence.
Mark Lawrence, thank you very much. Goes back to Hold That Ghost.
That's right. He's Charlie.
He was almost the title character, yeah. So having Patrick Knowles coming back and Mark Lawrence coming back, I think that's, to me, that's what adds to the fun, because you've already got these behind-the-scenes relationships built up. They've worked together before, and you can tell. You can tell just by watching them how they interact on screen.
Absolutely. And you can tell when they're having fun, definitely. Yeah. And they were big enough at this point that if they didn't enjoy working with someone, they could have said, no, I don't want to work with them again.
Yeah.
So you know that this is, it's kind of like a stock company in a way. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think Patrick Knowles really did some nice work with the boys. So, okay, Sheldon and Mark and Joe are plotting to rob the bank across the street from the hospital. Now, what they're going to do is they're going to put a do not disturb sign on their door, go rob the bank, and come back to the room, and they would have their alibi.
Yeah.
But the nurse is kind of suspicious. She's very suspicious, and this makes them a little uncomfortable. So here's what happens. The doctor, Dr. Patrick Knowles, his name is Bill Burns. Dr. Burns. And he's walking out of the hospital and he runs into Bud Abbott. Now, Bud Abbott is Flash. In fact, his name is Flash Fulton. And the hospital is Fulton Hospital. And I'm just wondering if Bud has maybe a doctor in the family. But, yeah, he's in charge of slapping the babies and butts. In the family world.
Certainly.
So he runs into Bud and he yells their childhood call was, "Wee-okie," That was their call. And yeah. Bud recognizes it and says, where did you hear that? And he goes, that was our thing. And they finally say, oh my God, we haven't seen each other in such a long time. We have to find Tubby. Let's find Tubby. He's around here. So Tubby and Flash are street photographers. Now, this used to be a pretty big business. In fact, the movie The Cameraman with Buster Keaton, he plays one of these guys. What they do is they take a picture of you on the street and they hand you a card with an address and you send them a quarter and they will send you the picture. So that's how it worked. And there are actually these guys. In fact, I think I remember this kind of thing happening in New York City. So they find Tubby, and Tubby is in a garbage can because he doesn't have to pay rent there for a dark room. And I call this Bud Abbott's Chico Marx moment. Now, if you know Chico Marx, especially in the movie The Coconuts, he has trouble remembering his lines. he doesn't remember the names of people, you know, and he just sort of flounders. And Bud has a moment like that. Now, if you remember, Bud was terrible at names, so he called everybody neighbor. Mm-hmm. Hey, neighbor. How are you, neighbor? Even on his mailbox at home. Hi, neighbor. But he forgot Bill's name. He remembered Burns, and he's saying, Lou says, who's him? I don't know who this guy is. Who's this guy? And Bud goes, it's Burns. Remember, you remember Burns? And Lou has to say, oh, Bill Burns? Ah. So anyway, I love that moment because Bud's lost. He's completely lost. I was waiting for him to call him neighbor. You know, neighbor Burns. So let's talk about our three villains, because let's face it, these guys are heavyweights. Lou wanted good casts. They gave him a good cast here. First, we have Sheldon Leonard. Now, Sheldon Leonard, born in New York City in 1907. So he's only a year younger than Lou. And he lived to 1997. He didn't quite make it to 90. He was in movies since 1934. He came from the stage, but he was at Warner Brothers in New York and at the Vitaphone studio. And he worked with like Shemp, you know, and people like that in short films doing comedies. And eventually, like in 1939 was his big breakout in Another Thin Man. And he became Hollywood's favorite gangster.
He had that voice, you know what I'm saying? he was big on radio too, you know, he was Jack Benny's racetrack tout.
Jack Benny would be going to buy gum, you know. It's like, hey, you, where are you going?
Well, I'm going to buy gum. What kind of gum? Well, I was thinking of Wrigley. You don't want Wrigley. And of course, you know, he sends him off to buy something completely different.
But he was a wonderful actor, a wonderful performer, best known, I would say, for It's a Wonderful Life as Nick the bartender. You know, out you two pixies go, out the door or through the window. I think that was it. but eventually, like all smart actors, he realized that the money was in producing. It was not in acting. So he became one of the top television producers of all time. He partnered with Danny Thomas, and they did the Andy Griffith Show and I Spy, which was very, you know, broke a lot of ground racially. The Danny Thomas Show, Make Room for Daddy, the Dick Van Dyke Show. I mean, really, really big time stuff. And if you're a fan of The Big Bang Theory, which I've only seen one episode of, apparently they pay tribute to Sheldon Leonard. Sheldon Cooper and Leonard Hofstadter are named after Sheldon Leonard. But he was amazing. He was truly amazing. Joseph Sawyer was born Joseph Sowers, S-A-U-E-R-S. He's from Ontario, Canada. And he was born the year Lou was born, in 1906. And he died in 1982 at the age of 75. Made some really, truly great movies. But he started his very first, was uncredited in the James Cagney movie, Public Enemy. He's no lines. He's playing pool, where Putty Nose hangs out. So he was there. And he stayed at Warner's for a while and played various tough guys. He co-starred with the annoying William Tracy in a series of Hal Roach Streamliners. Now, Streamliners was one of the great ideas that Hal Roach had, along with partnership with Mussolini's son and and teaming Billy Gilbert and Ben Blue. In fact, those movies, Blue. Those streamliners, that he got the idea, instead of, he built movies for double features. They were only like 40 minutes long. And most of them that I've seen, it's 40 minutes too long. He shows up in other Abbott and Costello movies. He's wonderful in the Naughty 90s, a couple of years after this, as their foil. He's just hilarious. And he shows up as a hillbilly in Coming Round the Mountain. Yep. Very memorable.
Wilbert.
Well, that was Glenn Strange, actually.
Yeah.
anyway, baby boomers might remember him best from the Rin Tin Tin television show. He was Sergeant Biff O'Hara. And talking about Mark Lawrence, this one's a little bit more controversial. I saved him for last. He was born in 1910 in New York City. Big surprise. He lived all the way to 2005. At 95 years old, he passed away. He was one of a slew of Eastern European Jewish guys who played Italian gangsters for a living. He was very swarthy, you know. His skin was horrible. He had terrible pockmarks and scars, and it worked beautifully for the gangsters he played in Hollywood. And as much as Sheldon Leonard, he just didn't often play the boss like Sheldon Leonard did. He was usually a henchman. But anyway, the bad thing about it was he was a communist for a couple of years in the 1930s, and he got called before the House Un-America Committee. And he named names. He named big names. Sterling Hayden, Lionel Stander, Ann Revere, Larry Parks, Karen Morley, and Jeff Corey. Wow. He named all of these people. And all of these people were affected by it, their work and everything. He was exiled, basically, to Europe, where he made movies for a while up until the 1970s. He came back, and he started working again. And he worked all the way up to Looney Tunes back in action.
Yes.
But yeah, name names. That's that's a whole other episode we can talk about. Because you have to put yourself in their place. We talk about, you know, when you start getting offers after struggling for so many years, and then all of a sudden it could all be taken away because you don't name names. So what do you do? You know? I have to say, though, that even when Ilya Kazan was getting his Oscar, I was kind of on the side of the people who were booing. You know, it's a tough call. Anyway, so that was Mark Lawrence. And those are our three wonderful gangsters. Okay, so they meet up with Burns. and all of a sudden, they hear sirens. And this is one of my favorite sequences. This is the fire, the big fire.
Yeah.
And they figure if they can get enough pictures of the fire, they can get hired by a newspaper to take pictures. So their doctor pal, Patrick Knowles, gives them a ride in an ambulance to get to the fire quickly. And the ambulance is, first of all, the driver. I don't know how they got away with this joke. It's kind of a Nance joke.
Yes.
Lou says, "Where's the fire?" And the guy just looks at him and says, "In your eye," and walks away. And Lou's thinking, "What? it's a weird moment."
Yep.
But also, that's Eddie Parker, the driver. And he was one of the great stuntmen. And he was the mummy in Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. But anyway, so they're doing the sequence in the ambulance. Of course, the stretcher that Bud and Lou are on comes loose, and it's being dragged along, and they're hanging on for dear life. And they do a war joke, a dated war joke.
Oh, I know what they mean by share the ride. Hey, what do you got, A or B coupon? Jokey. Come on, you got chicken with A or B. Be science. Hey, you'll have to get off now. I gotta get a retread. Come on.
Anyway, all these wartime jokes. So this starts one of my favorite sequences. Lou gets on the fireman's ladder, which is, of course, 80,000 feet, you know, high. And it takes him right up to a windowsill where the fire is just blazing. And the ladder goes away and leaves him hanging there. And Bud is on the ground, focusing his camera on him and just yelling, "Turn around, we want to see your face, turn around." And he's hanging with one hand while the fire is raging. And Bud just wants to get a picture of him. Lou loses his grip. He bounces off a car and whatever. He bounces off three different things and lands in the stretcher. And they have to take him to the hospital. So they go to the Fulton Hospital. Dr. Bill says, I'll go and set up, the room for you. You guys wait here. Lou, while Bud is noticing a pretty nurse and he walks away, Lou's stretcher kind of rolls right in front of the maternity ward. Now he's got this thing around his head. You can't see his hair and he's covered by a blanket. So he could be a chubby little woman actually. So these two nurses come out and, and tell Lou that he just had a baby. And Lou buys into it and says, really? I just had a baby. What is it, a boy or a girl? And they say, it's a boy. A boy. And of course, I'm thinking to myself, he really did have a boy a few weeks ago. this must be very nice for him right now. But anyway, of course, the hair thing comes out and they see that he's really a guy and the nurse faints. It's a really sweet moment. It's really nice. But this is the moment where I'm going to ask you, Jerry, you got to hit the dialogue on this one. The gangsters are in their hospital room and they hired two guys from Detroit, two trigger men from Detroit to cover them when they come out of the bank. Now they were going to hire these guys as, you know, freelance guys. And they said that there's a signal. Is the doctor in? That's the signal. So Bud and Lou start looking for the doctor. And of course, the first room they go into is Sheldon Leonard and the gangsters. And they say, is the doctor in? This is how the dialogue goes. And remember, they're photographers. Here we go.
Is the doc here?
Well, it's about time you boys got here.
Where you guys been?
Working.
Doing what?
Shooting people. Perfect day for it.
You mean you've already shot somebody today?
We've got to make a living, haven't we?
How'd you do it?
Well, he just sticks them up against the wall and shoots them.
Yeah, at the prices we charge, we can't be fussy.
Say, were you in on a deal?
No, I was shooting a cop down on the corner. Hey, what do you charge for shooting cops?
Cops? Free. The reason why we make it free for the cops is because when we're shooting other people, they never bother us.
Now, let's get this clear, boys. With me, you've got to keep this shooting down to a minimum.
This is terrific stuff. This is just...
It really is. It really is. And what I love about it is with the history that they have, especially Lou, for ad-libbing and just looking at a script and then going from there, this sounds very well written. The scene is very well constructed and very well delivered as well.
Yes, I agree. There's a great still that was taken during the scene where everybody is just going nuts. They're just, Lou is on the bed choking Sheldon and Bud's choking, you know. It's a great, great picture. But it kind of disturbs me in the sense that later interviews with Sheldon Leonard, not only did he not like working with the Bowery Boys, but he didn't like working with Abbott and Costello from what he said. But I have a feeling he felt that way about comedians in general when you think about it. Comedians can be a real pain. Because they know exactly what they want. They know the timing they want. They know how they want straight lines delivered, you know, things like that, timing and everything. Yeah. So it's not easy. It's not an easy thing. But he did say, interestingly, he worked on two of their films. This one in 1942, they shot it. And then Invisible Man, which was 1951. So it was almost, you know, a decade later. And he said the difference was apparent. They were more concerned about getting home early during the later film. So he got to see them in both ways, both modes. So, okay, they think they're the boys from Detroit. They set up the robbery. And as they go to do it, our nurse, Elise Knox, comes in and notices that Sheldon Leonard's bed has been infiltrated by pillows. It's apparent that Mike Lindell has been redecorating his room. okay. Enough of this pillow talk. So she notices that it's pillows. It's not Sheldon Leonard, you know, and you got to figure pillows can't produce a television show. So
this
right
is
away.
True.
So anyway, she notices that things are bad. So she's definitely someone that they have to keep an eye on because she knows. So the boys are downstairs to cover the gangsters. And there's a joke that I can't believe got by the censors. Now, I don't know if it got by you, Jerry, but it's a dirty joke.
Yep.
Okay, I think you know what I'm talking about. They're standing in front of the bank with their cameras. Lou is focusing his lens. And as he's focusing, this woman walks by, this beautiful woman walks by, shaking her derriere to the point where it looks like she's making a cocktail, and so to speak. And Lou starts following her and bumps into a lamppost, you know, and I actually love that he tries to go through the lamppost.
Yes.
But Bud stops him and says, what are you doing? We have to do this at the bank. And Lou says, I thought I'd pick up a little on the side. Now, that's a dirty joke. That's a sex joke. He even looks at us like that to make sure we know that he's being a bad boy.
Oh, yeah.
But it is a funny joke. So anyway, so the gangsters do the thing. Bud and Lou take the pictures, and they think that's all they have to do. And eventually, the gangsters decide that... No. We're missing probably the scene that makes me laugh the most is the bank. Mm-hmm. After the gangsters leave, Bud and Lou realize that the bank should be closed at this point. It's past 3 o'clock, and they notice that the door is open, and they go in. So they notice at this point that there's nobody there, and Bud just says,
"Tell her. Tell who? Tell her. I'll tell her where she. Where is who? I said tell her.
Tell her what?
Tell her nothing. I want to tell her.
Well, go ahead and tell her. I don't care.
No. Tell her in the bank.
Tell her in the bank. Tell her outside. Tell her any place you want. I won't listen. Listen.
When I say tell her, I don't mean tell her.
Well, what do you mean?
Tell her.
Tell her.
Now you've got it.
No, I got it. I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Oh, come on. Get out of the way. Get out of the way.
Don't hit my camera.
Come on, let's look around here. There's someone here.
Well, it's so rough.
Hello? Hey, Flash. Get this size of the big icebox. Anybody in there?
Only a couple of guys with a toothache.
How do you know they've got a toothache? They got plaster over their mouth. The bank's stuck up.
What's this bank got to be stuck up about? It's no better than the other bank.
It's been robbed.
That's against the law.
Certainly it is. And if we're caught in here, they'll blame us for the stick-up.
Now, I don't know if you know this, but I'm a big fan of the outtakes from the Abbott and Costello movies. And there is a major one, this movie especially. We catch him at the bank vault. He notices that the bank workers are in there all tied up and gagged. But anyway, he starts playing with the wheel on this enormous safe. There's this big wheel, and he starts doing all this nautical language. Oh, you on the port side, on the mizzenmast, little. And there's a smaller one next to it, and he starts playing with that, and he says, this one here's for a small boat. And in this outtake, he turns and smiles at the director, at Charlie Lamont, off camera, like a little boy who did something really nice, who did something really well. And it's a sweet moment. It really is. But they kept that take and they cut it just at that time. Mm-hmm. So we have that wonderful ad lib from Lou. And there's another one that they left. Oh, now that I'm thinking of it, when they're in the train station and he sees Ginny Sims for the first time and he's totally smitten with her and he can't stop looking at her. And Bud's like trying to snap him out of it. You know, he's slapping him in the face and Lou just turns to him and gets right up into his face like he wants to kiss him. And Bud pushes him away and says, "Will you get away from me?" And they use that take. When you see the outtake, Lou next takes his hand and brushes it up on Bud's crotch. And Bud is like, "Ooh, get away from me." It's a very funny moment, but they use that take. They just cut it at the right time.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the bank stuff is just golden. Ed Gargan, our character actor, he's the cop who comes in. And Lou, again, is ad-libbing like crazy. Ed Gargan comes in. He's a really friendly, smiling cop. And when he leaves, Lou says, "Doesn't he have a nice smile? That's a good-looking cop." I can't believe they left it in. He's just talking about the cop. Well, anyway, they have to get out of there. The place is like, you know, Lou has stepped on all the alarms. So the place is, you know, inundated with police and they have to get out. So they pull the old gag where they have two long poles. Now, I don't know where they got these things, but they have these two long poles and they put loose shoes on the end of each pole. And then they put a blanket over the poles, and Lou is at the top. You don't see Lou's bottom part. You only see his head and his neck. And it looks like Bud is carrying him out on a stretcher. And it's very funny. And as they're walking out, of course, the cop steps on the blanket or the sheet and it's exposed and starts running after him. Now, that cop is comedy veteran Eddie Dunn, who is in movies, God, comedies, I can't even count. He must have made 400 short films, a lot of them at Hal Roach, a lot of them with Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chase. But I love when he's running after Lou. And Lou stops to take a picture of him and he poses. And then they continue running.
Yes.
That was kind of fun. I enjoyed that. But that leads us up to probably the most famous of the burlesque routines in this film. Mm-hmm. And that's packing and unpacking.
Yeah.
It's a classic. And nobody does it better. And they've done it several times. They did it in this movie. They do it in Noose Hangs High. They did it in the Colgate Comedy Hour and their film television show. So they pretty much covered it with this routine. So yeah, they're actually blamed for the robbery. And the newspaper has a drawing of the two of them, you know, a descriptive drawing. And Lou, again, is like, and look at the fat puss they made on me. I can't believe it. He's commenting through this entire film. He also breaks the fourth wall quite a bit.
Yes.
You know, which I love.
I think more so in this film than almost any of their others. Yeah.
He does. He said, we're his partners in this one.
Yeah.
So they're blamed and they have to hightail it, you know? So they do packing and unpacking. What that is that Bud goes off. And this is, to me, this is Bud's highlight. This is what Bud did best. Mm-hmm. You know, when you listen to his dialogue, he's making it up as he goes along. And it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful. And he knows every beat and when to get to that beat. If you love comedy, if you love studying comedy, this is a bit to study. So basically, it's Lou taking out their suitcase and packing it up on Bud's advice because they have to get out of town. But then Bud starts to change his mind. And, you know, we can get a lawyer and a lawyer can help us unpack that grip. So Lou has to unpack the grip. Wait a minute. We can't afford a lawyer. We don't have any money. And it goes on like that. And he just packs and unpacks and packs and unpacks. And finally, the ending is really interesting. It's the only time they used it.
Yes.
Right? Finally, Bud says, okay, pack the grip. And Lou just opens up the grip, snaps his fingers, and all the clothing magically goes into the suitcase. And the suitcase closes. It's really sweet. It's really nice. But then there's, again, I don't know where Joseph Breen was when this movie came out.
Yes.
Okay. They have a Murphy bed. A Murphy bed comes out of the wall. And to end the scene, Bud slaps Lou. Lou gets pushed back into the bed. The bed goes into the wall. And Lou goes through the wall into the next room, into the bed, the Murphy bed in the next apartment, where there is a man and woman in the same bed. Now, mm-hmm. that may not seem like a big deal to you youngsters out there who don't know what a payphone is, but one of the major rules was you could not have a man and woman in the same bed. Even if they were married, mm-hmm. the man would have, or whoever it was, would have to have at least 1 foot on the floor. That's how rigid this was. But I can't believe it. They were the two in bed together.
Maybe the fact that Lou was in between them took a little bit of the sting off of it. I don't know.
I don't know. To me, it's an imagined flaw now. You know, it's even dirtier.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. But, you know, maybe he just had brain damage.
Ooh.
So moving on from that.
Please.
Thank you. One of my favorite Bing Crosby songs. Now we are, did we mention Ginny Simpson? Now,
Ginny
Simpson. Now, I don't know about you, Jerry, but when I was growing up and watching this film, Ginny Sims was, to me, was just like, perfection. I just thought, I would sigh. I would look at her and just like, you know, yeah, we're going to have children and we're going to settle down, me and this dead woman. I think the psychological term for that is limerage. Limerage is forming a relationship with someone you couldn't possibly have a relationship with.
Oh.
It's all in your head. So yeah, that was my limerage when I was young. And she's just gorgeous. She wasn't always this gorgeous. She did have about a year or two before this, she had major face surgery. Her nose was cut down to a perfect little nose, and even her face, her eyes.
Wow.
She had a lot of work done, and she looks great. I'm not usually a proponent of facial work, and she was attractive beforehand, but boy, I don't know who did her work, but it was incredible. She really is beautiful, and she has a gorgeous voice. Now, Jenny Sims, if you don't know Jenny Sims, she was the lead vocalist with a very popular Kay Kaiser and his orchestra, and she was featured on his radio show, The College of Musical Knowledge, and she was actually engaged to Kay, and eventually she broke it off. And the engagement, I mean, and she got her own radio show. She went solo, and she was pursued ardently by Louis B. Mayer, of all people, who wanted to marry her, even though he was married. He wanted to marry her and make her a major star at MGM. Huh. And she just couldn't do it. She just couldn't do it. But she married well. One of her husbands was the Hyatt. I believe it was the Hyatt people. The hotel people. And and she lived a fairly long life. I think she lived to be 80. And she left us with some really, really beautiful vocals. She had like butter, you know, her voice is smooth, smooth as silk. Just a beautiful, beautiful woman. So we did packing and unpacking. Now the boys have to get out of town. They know that Sheldon Leonard and the gangsters are going. And they have to clear themselves because the cops are still after Bud and Lou. So they have to follow the gangsters and make sure that, you know, the cops are directed in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So they go on the same train. They don't have money, but they do have a very famous encounter with a wonderful comedian by the name of Mantan Moreland. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Lou walks into him. It's just a two shot. These two great comedians of the 20th century in the same shot. Mantan is a train porter, of course, and he's walking with a set of snowshoes. And Lou says, "Oh, look, tennis." And Mantan tops him by saying, "Don't you know a fly swatter when you see one?" And that's it. That shining moment between those two wonderful, wonderful comedians. So the boys have to get on the train, and Johnny Long and his orchestra are on the train, of course, because if you're in an Abbott and Costello movie and there is a train, there is an orchestra. Happened all the time. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Where am I? Oh, conductor, where am I sitting? Over there in the read section. but I don't read. So the boys do another baseball-y routine. The orchestra is checking in with the conductor to get on the train. And one guy's going, first saxophone, second saxophone, first base, second base. Bud says, third base. And Lou says, shortstop. And walks in. And the guy's like, shortstop, come back here. Again, that's another outtake where Lou actually comes back and says to Charlie Lamont, okay, is that better? Is that better? Or something like that. It's just so funny. These outtakes are like, it shows you exactly who these people are, you know, and how they were feeling that day. I just love that. I don't know. It's like getting a window into something private. So they get on the train and we have our first song. With the orchestra and Ginny Sims. We also find out that Ginny and Johnny are an item. They are in love. Johnny Long, the orchestra leader, and Ginny Sims. She sings a song called Like a Fish Out of Water, which is a really good song. Yeah. And it's one of those songs that mentions a lot of pop culture figures of the day. You'll hear Hedy Lamarr, just like Hedy without a Lamarr. Walt Disney, Joe DiMaggio, Cole Porter, Gypsy Rose Lee. All those people are mentioned in this song. Abbott and Costello didn't get along with Gypsy Rose Lee. I wonder if they blanched when they heard that lyric. So yeah, they're on the train and Lou professes his love for Ginny Simms. You know, Bud, of course, you know, don't you see, she loves Johnny Long. But then they see they have to hide from the conductors because they don't have tickets. And they do something brilliant. Something I love is when Lou actually comes up with the idea. They sit down in an empty seat, and when the conductor comes, they put their wrists together and hold them up like they're handcuffs. And Bud says, FBI, we're transporting this guy to prison. And it's clever. It's really clever. And they get away with it until Lou says goodbye. He ruins it by tipping his hat with the hand that was in the handcuff. But anyway, so the chase continues. We see that the gangsters are on the train. The gangsters know that Bud and Lou are on the train. They have to get the photograph. So the gangsters want the photograph. Abbott and Costello want their innocence proven. So that's what everybody wants.
Yep.
At this point, the doctor is also involved. He's there to take care of Sheldon Leonard as his private physician. And the nurse was asked also to come up because she's dangerous. She knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So the first of Lou losing his pants comes now. They're hiding from the conductor. And of course, poor Lou is hanging outside the window of the train. And he has to rely on Bud to help him get back in, which is tantamount to having someone push you out, basically. Bud pretty much tells him where to put his hands and then says, okay, come on in. So Lou has to do it on his own. Before he can, the thing that grabs the mail, you know, mm-hmm. As the train goes by, it grabs Lou's pants and he's left pantsless. He goes to Sun Valley and he's going to get the sun in a place where other people aren't. in his valley. Okay, so they get you Sun Valley, and we immediately have another song. But I have to say, it's a song I love, mm-hmm. and it's the slap polka.
Yes,
first slap and double slap. Can we play a little bit of that? Just a little bit.
Sure.
First, grab a partner, then let each felon bowl. Join hands together and do a figure O. But if your heartbeat is 23 below, you turn and clap, and then you slap. Here's my advice to each farmer in the dell. If Willie loves you and you love Willie well, let Willie kiss you, but don't let William tell. Or Mama slap, a double slap. Ole ole, ole ole, this is the slap happy polka of the day.
That's a very memorable one from childhood.
Oh yeah, I vividly remember that song, more so than almost any other than Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, probably my number two memory of a song from an Abbott and Costello movie, just the fact that they're actually slapping each other as they're dancing. And I thought, now if I start dancing, that's how I want to do it.
I always thought they missed the boat, though. They should have had Bud sing this song, you know, and slap him at the buddy. That would have been the way to present that song. Okay, so Lou is watching her sing at one point. I remember this. And one of the funniest things to me that Lou does is when he's romantically smitten and he puts his hands on top of his head, he'll mm-hmm. put his tie in his mouth, you know, he'll do all these like things that a little kid would do. And in this one, he gets his hand caught in a drink and he can't get it out. And he's pulling it. And of course, that wonderful sound effect, that suction sound effect, you know, and the pop. Anyway, this leads to probably the second most popular burlesque routine in the movie, and that is the piano scene. And some people just call it all right. Basically, Lou knows that Ginny Simms loves musicians, and there happens to be a piano there by the pool at this resort. And Bud comes up with an idea. Now, by this time, they're working as waiters at this resort. Mm-hmm. It's like Ride'em Cowboy, you know, Johnny Long got them a job here and said the most condescending thing. They thanked him for the jobs. And he's just like, I'm happy to help, boys, but just try to see that you keep them. It's like, shut up. Go wave your stick around and leave me alone. And also, you know, these guys all came from the same neighborhood. right? Patrick Knowles with his British accent.
Yeah.
Johnny Long with his North Carolina accent and Bud and Lou with their New Jersey accent. Where did they grow up?
Cleveland.
I wouldn't wish that on anyone. But anyway, I love Cleveland. My mom's from Cleveland. So they're doing the piano bit, and Bud comes up with the idea that he will sit behind the piano with a Victrola, which is a record player for those of you kids who don't know what a payphone is. So he's got the record player, and he's got one record of piano solo, classical solo. And he tells Lou, when you say, all right, I'll put on the record and you pretend to play and she'll think you're a musician and blah, blah, blah. It's one of their stupider contrivances, you know. First and foremost, where did they find a piano that the keys didn't move when you hit them?
Yes.
You know, he's pounding on this piano and there's no noise other than the record. So there's that. And of course, you know, we see her smile. She's onto it from the beginning because every time someone says, all right, Bud puts the record on and Lou has to run and scramble back to the piano. It's a very funny bit. They make it funny.
Yeah.
Like Who's On First. They take a very contrived situation and make it seem natural, you know, in their hands.
Yeah.
And then there's a really sweet moment where she discovers him, you know, that it's a ruse, and she yells at him, and I thought you were an honest person, and I thought I could trust you, and blah, blah, blah. And he's backing up, and he's right at the edge of the swimming pool, and she walks away, and he turns to us and says, I'll bet you thought I was going to fall in, didn't you? And then a girl, a beautiful girl, walks by, and he faints and falls into the pool. So,
yes.
I love that. So, yeah, so that's the piano scene.
Okay, quick question before we move away from this. I know, obviously, it's in this movie. I know they did it on their film TV show, the piano, the All Right thing. Did they do it on Colgate?
Yes. I missed that one. Gail Storm. Gail Storm.
Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, the father was Murray Leonard. Yeah. Also, how about that? I'm sorry to stop this now, but I want to remember this before I forget.
Yeah.
How about that Lou Costello scene on Steve Allen show from Cuba?
That was incredible because you know the routine, but it was different and they're taking it different directions and different jokes, but it was still the same bit.
And just as funny.
Oh, yes.
You didn't have to get hit and pushed.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
So I don't know. I found it fascinating. I found it really fascinating. I think he did a couple of shows with them from Cuba. Mm-hmm. Okay, so where are we? We just finished
the piano bit.
Piano. Okay. The seduction scene.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in a lot of Abbott and Costello movies, there's usually a beautiful femme fatale who has to seduce Lou into doing something for them. Now, in this movie, Ginny Simms is an honest person, but she had a past with Sheldon Leonard. And he was obviously a club owner that she worked for, you know, and they became friends. Who knows? But anyway, he asked her to do this favor for him, seduce Lou and try and get the photographs from him. And this is a very funny scene. But I have a what if for you, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
In this scene, she's, again, trying to seduce him. It's very funny when she's behind him and she picks up the piece of chicken and he looks at it's like he has three hands.
Yes.
I love that. But there's a thing where she keeps asking, can I see the picture? And he says, no. And then she may ask it again and he says, no. And then finally on the third one, after she kisses him, she goes, now can I see the pictures? And he stops and he walks over to the door and he listens and he locks it and he looks over to the other door and he comes back and he says, no. Now, we all know he's going to say it, right? It takes a long time to get there.
Yep.
And we all know the punchline. We're there ahead of him.
Yes.
Here's my suggestion. Now, if I were directing, this is what I would have suggested. Lou, when she asks, now can I see the picture? Do the same thing. Go over to the door. Look at it, lock it, go over to the other door, look to see nobody's there, turn around, go up to her and put your hand in your pocket like you're going to take it out. And then take it out, only it's a piece of gum, and put it in your mouth and go, no. That would have, to me, it would have made the scene. We would not have guessed it. We would have think that when he's putting his hand in his pocket, he's showing her the picture.
Yeah.
So anyway,
yeah.
That's just my years of comic training. So the seducing scene is great. And then there's the crack the whip scene, which is maybe the most famous scene in the movie. I heard from Joe Adamson today, who said that when he was a kid, he had the Castle Film version of the crack the whip in the skating scene. And he said it's one of the funniest physical comedy scenes I've ever seen.
Wow. I didn't know that they had issued that one. I've got most of the Castle Film, Abbott and Costello's, and I don't have that one. Okay.
And the thing about it, it's perfect. It's, it's, you know, it's all action. And in that scene, and I do mention this in our book, the annotated Abbott and Costello, during that skating scene, okay, it's a big outdoor set. It was shot at Sonia Henie's ice rink in Westwood, California. It's not there anymore. It's long gone. But yeah, I used to live in Westwood and she had that ice skating rink. But anyway, there are three cooks, three chefs wearing their, you know, their toques, hats and all that stuff. And they're standing there, you know, at a buffet behind the food and they don't say anything. They're just sort of looking and responding. One of them is Dan Seymour. Now, I don't know if you know Dan Seymour, right?
Oh, yeah.
Casablanca?
Yes.
Have and have not.
Even I mean, a night in Casablanca with the Marx Brothers, yes.
Right, exactly, exactly. He's a major guy, a major supporting player. He was also big on radio. He was a big announcer. Mm-hmm. And he was the guy, you are there. He did the voice. But anyway, he's just standing there and he's just reacting. He's just looking around. He has nothing to do. Absolutely nothing. So I love stuff like that. And the little girl skating around Lou. That is Cordelia Campbell. And she only made one other movie. And she did a scene just like this in a movie called The Late George Apley. And if you notice, when Lou is spinning around, he's doing, what do you call that? That's not an axle. But when they stand in one spot and they spin.
Yeah.
Really fast.
Whatever they call that. Yeah.
I think it's the nauseous. So I just thought I'd throw that up. But so Lou is spinning, and if you slow it down, if you slow down the picture and do it frame by frame, Lou is losing it. He's laughing the entire time, and it's real. I mean, it's not put on. Lou is just like, I'm sure he's uncomfortable, and he's joking around and laughing. So if you ever get the chance when you're watching it, that's something to look for. But then the crack the whip is just incredible, leading to that wonderful finish where his legs are sticking up and his head comes up behind them.
Yes.
It's like he's bent in a way that's totally impossible.
Yes. It's almost painful to look at. Yeah.
It really is. And when his head pops out, that sound effect, that Joe Adamson was correct. Joe, you are correct. That is a wonderful sequence. So I just have to do this quickly because I know we're running out of time. I have two bins here. One is out mail and one is in mail. And I'm noticing that I do have a package from Kevin Brownlow.
Oh, no.
And there is some tape here that I did. It is just way too important not to play for our Abbott and Costello aficionados. And I'm going to do this now. And this is something I don't think even you knew, Jerry.
Okay.
In the early 1950s, when they were casting Streetcar Named Desire, the film, Bud wasn't sure if he was going to continue with Abbott and Costello. They weren't getting along too well. You know, some of the scripts weren't that great and whatever. So he was looking to expand, you know, and look into some other roles. And we do have some audio from his audition. Hold on. I believe that's Ilya Kazan is running it. Hold on a second. And there we go. Okay, Gadge, you tell me and I'll do whatever. You just tell me when to come in. Okay, Bud. Okay, Bud. Thank you very much. That's good. Okay, Vivian, thank you for doing this for Bud. This is it's just above and beyond. It's above and beyond. Oh, that's all right. That's all right. Let's go. Just tell me when. Okay, here we go. Are we ready, Bud?
I'm ready. Would you hurry up? Let's go.
All right, here we go. Action.
I have always relied on the kindness of strangers.
Yes, I understand that. But nowadays, we've got the Napoleonic Code. And nowadays, Napoleonic Codes have strange names.
Funny names?
Yes, funny names. Like what?
What?
Yes!
Wait, who?
No! What? That's another code. What are you talking about? Come here, you. That's terrible. You know what? I need help. Costella! Costella!
And that's where it ends. At least we had more. But you know that he didn't make it. They went with Marlon Brando from the stage. You know?
Yeah.
And Ralph Meeker took over on Broadway. But anyway, I just thought that would be important. That's a very little known part of Bud's career.
Yes, so and unfortunately, it didn't stay little known. So there you go.
I give you Vivian Lee and and you're giving me Souris over here? What is this? Okay. Right. So getting back to the movie.
Yes.
Yes. So they did the seduction scene, they did the crack the whip scene. Well, now they all have to meet at Sheldon Leonard's cabin, which is out in the wilderness. So they have to take the sled dogs and all that. And by this time, the doctor is on to them, the nurse is on to them, and now it's time to, you know, settle up with everybody. So they end up at the cabin. Bud pretends to shoot the doctor and the nurse. He takes them outside with a gun, and you hear bang, bang, and then he sends them off, you know, to get the cops, basically. So before all of that happens, Bud and Lou do a very Laurel and Hardy type thing where they have to get into the house. And Bud says, you know what? I think we can crawl in through the window. And Lou has already figured out that the door is open. So he walks in and he unlocks the window and opens it for Bud, then goes outside again and helps Bud through the window. And Bud's like, why didn't you tell me the door? He said you wanted to go through the window. Anyway, so they do a bunch of jokes. I'm sure it's almost like Joe Miller's joke book was on the set that day.
Yeah.
You know, they see the bearskin rug. Mm-hmm. It's like, did you ever hunt bear? No, I always had my clothes on. You know, all those hunting jokes. But that leads to another burlesque chestnut, and that's You Can't Punch Me.
Yes.
Standing on the edge of the handkerchiefs. Now, they did this in every television thing and whatever. It's a popular bit with them. And basically, Bud tells Lou that if I put a handkerchief on the floor and you stand on one end and I stand on the other, I'll bet you $10 that you can't punch me in the nose. So Lou is like, oh, of course I can do that. Are you crazy? So Bud lays the handkerchief down in the door jamb, and Lou gets on one end and Bud closes the door. So there's no way Lou can punch him in the nose. So he loses the bet. Okay. But this leads up to Lou trying it. And of course, every time Lou tries something, it backfires.
Yeah.
So they're all meeting in the place. They're all there. And I told you, Bud went out and pretended to shoot the guys. So Lou gets into it with Joe Sawyer. Now, Joe Sawyer, you know, is 6'2", and Lou is like 5'5". So Lou says, you know, I'll bet I could put a handkerchief on the floor and I can stand on one end, you can stand on the other. So they agree. They make the bet. And Lou puts it down on the door jamb, closes the door. And what happens? Joe Sawyer punches through the door and knocks Lou cold. And that's when they find out that the gun he had been holding on them was actually a banana. And one of my favorite lines comes from Sheldon Leonard, who takes the banana and throws it at him and says, "Why the little monkey?" which might have been an ad lib, you know, because there was a banana.
Yeah.
Okay, so through machinations with Ginny Sims, the gangsters are knocked out by a vase that Lou gets stuck on his hand, and they make their escape. The gangsters wake up, and there is a big chase, a big Abbott and Costello chase on skis in the snow. And of course, our fake bear comes back, you know, from Ride 'Em Cowboy. And and what was the other one? There was another one with the bear that shows
Naughty
up.
Naughty 90s.
That's right. The bear routine. Yeah. So yeah, they're skiing, you know, down the line, and they're subduing the gangsters. And the cops are waiting at the bottom of the hill. So the gangsters go right into the cops. And finally, Sheldon Leonard and Lou get into it. They get into a fight and they do the rolling ball, the snowball, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, it's chasing after Bud, and Bud's trying to get out of the way. So finally, it gets to the bottom. Lou comes out, and of course they get rid of Sheldon Leonard, and Lou sees that, you know, a rabbit is inside, and he takes it out and he says, "Oh, a hitchhiker," you know, and he goes, go away. So he sees another animal and he goes, "Oh, another hitchhiker," and he pulls it out, and he notices everybody else starts running away at top speed into the distance. You just see them running in fast motion, and you see that Lou is holding up a skunk. And that leads to, of course, a fabulous Lou faint face first into the snow.
Yeah.
Now, that leads to probably my favorite song in the whole movie. And that's the one that kind of mirrors Johnny Long's hit, Shanty and Old Shanty Town, where the orchestra sings. The entire band sings a rhythmic lyric. And it's just so much fun. Can we play a little bit of that?
Mr. Thumbs, beat those drums. Solid jaw.
I hope, we're leaving track 11. So skin the mittens up around, skin them round. We'll ride the slide and high sea up to heaven. We're happy and happiness bound.
And then we cut to the train station, where Bud and Lou are waiting. Because of the way she worded it, Ginny Sims, she told Lou, "We're going to be married." And Lou, of course, thought it was the two of them rather than her and Johnny Long. She's actually marrying Johnny Long. But Bud and Lou are dressed for a wedding at the train station, waiting for Ginny so he can marry her. And this leads to one of Lou's pathos scenes, where he finds out finally that she's not in love with him. She's in love with Johnny Long. And he sees everybody happy on the train. He's outside the train and all the windows are going by. And you see Patrick Knowles kissing Elise Knox. You see Bud kissing a girl. I don't know how he met this girl. And you know, in like 2 seconds, he's kissing her. And Lou kind of says to nobody in particular, he's got tears in his eyes. And he says, "If I ever fall in love with another girl, I hope they hang me." And of course, a girl goes by in the window and winks at him, and he winks back at her. And of course the male thing catches him again and around his throat. So he is being hung as the train is taking him away. And as the topper, as he's going off camera, hanging from this thing by his neck off the train, you hear and you see his pants hanging on the male again. And it says "the end" right where you would put "the end."
Yes.
And that is "Hit the Ice." Are you privy to the outtake from the train depot where they're waiting for Sims?
And yes.
Lou has to tinkle. He can't keep still. Yeah. Lou was pretty honest during those outtakes.
Yeah.
But you can see they're having a good time. They're laughing. Ginny Sims in later interviews said that she had the time of her life with those guys, with Abbott and Costello. She really loved working with them. She had a lot of trouble keeping a straight face. In fact, you could see her, especially during the piano scene.
Yeah.
You could see her trying to keep a straight face during that. She just said that you looked at your lines the night before and you'd go in and you wouldn't recognize any of your cues because they never gave you the right cues. And you had to learn how to work with them. You know, it was just their way. So anyway, that is "Hit the Ice." And I told you, I would tell you at the end that it does not end happily. Because of their extreme schedule that I mentioned earlier, Lou developed rheumatic fever. Now, that is incredibly rough on your heart. And you can't move. Once you get that, you are confined to bed. Now, I've heard different things. I've heard he was in bed for 6 months. I heard he was in bed for 8 months, for a year. But the thing to remember is that while he was recovering, not only did Bud come on a regular basis, you know, to cheer him up, which was great. And Bud did not work at all while Lou was gone. He got to watch his baby boy learn to walk. They, in fact, they learned to walk together during that time. So while Lou was trying to get out of bed and trying to regain his strength, he was watching his little boy do the same thing, basically. Mm-hmm. So I think that's beautiful. Yeah. But it was not a happy thing. It was not a happy thing. He struggled. He suffered. He would get letters from all over the country from kids who actually had rheumatic fever. And he would write back every one of them and tell them, just listen to your doctors. Don't move. Just stay and you know, stay in bed. So it was a quite an experience. And it was a recurring thing, unfortunately. And it was the thing that eventually killed him at an early age. So I'm going to leave it there. And we'll pick it up at that point, because the boys now are going to get a very long break, a forced one.
Yes,
but a long and well-deserved, well-deserved break before they started on their next film, In Society. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to hear about a movie Lou produced called A Wave, A Whack, and A Marine. Monogram Studios, also with Elise Knox from this movie, from Hit the Ice. So anyway, that's it. That was our look at Hit the Ice. Yeah. We hope you had a good time. Jerry, did you have a good time?
I always have a good time, Nick, in spite of any comments I might make to the contrary during the process. It's always enjoyable. And I just want to throw in right here to all of our listeners, you know, both of them. I want to say, if you enjoy this podcast, you know, Nick had mentioned earlier about trying to figure out ways to promote and get the word out. The best way to do that is for you to look at your friends and say, I have been listening to the best podcast ever. And tell your friends, tell your friends, tell your friends.
And then if you tell two friends, then they'll tell two friends, and they'll tell two friends, and then you've got six people. Yeah. So anyway, no, thank you, Jerry. That's that needed to be said. Yeah. I really do want it to become, you know, something people look forward to. And to be honest with you, I'm going to close with this. Okay. When I appear on other people's podcasts, and I've done a slew of them, I can't listen to them. I'm in like 10 minutes, and then I can't stand listening to myself, to be honest with you. But I like our podcast. I could listen to our podcast. Mm. It doesn't bother me a bit. You know, I think we've got something here.
There you go.
And I really want people to share it if you enjoy it. Okay. So let's make a deal. Monty Hall, and we will see you for In Society, and we'll record that in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
All right. Thank you again, Jerry. Always a pleasure. Everybody take care, and, you know, watch Abbott and Costello. You'll like it.